Hey everyone, Vito from More Beer here. We're in Louisville, Kentucky, outside of Kentucky Peerless. We're gonna go inside, talk about bourbon and distilling. If you like spirits, this is the episode for you. All right, let's start with John Gwynn. Tell me about your history, you know, what you do here, kind of your background in distillation. Yeah.
Okay, my name is Gwen. I've been with Peerless now for a little over 2 years. I started out as a tour guide, but now I found my way to our production area. So my background is I was in the fuel ethanol industry previously, so know a lot about the production part of the process, but we didn't drink the stuff. So this is a lot more fun, a lot more interesting, really learning a lot about just kind of the sensory analysis. And so people like John have helped me a lot along the way. And so being part of the production group is really, it's just kind of feel like I really found my, you know, where I want to be. So that's a little bit about my background.
Yeah, so born and raised here in Louisville, Kentucky. Been with Peerless for almost 8 years now. Got in it from like the bartending side of things. Being here, love bourbon, grew up with it around here. Now I run our barrel program here. So my official title is single barrel curator. But you'll find myself, Gwen, we do a little bit of everything around here, whether it's running the still, tasting through barrels, going out and doing some market work, or just doing tours up front.
Tell me a little bit about Kentucky Peerless Distilling.
So we're family owned and operated. We're owned by the fourth and fifth generation, Corky and Carson Taylor. His great grandfather, Henry Craver, started this back in 1889 in Henderson, Kentucky. You know, we closed down our doors during Prohibition, and sadly, his great grandfather passed away during Prohibition. So it wasn't until about 100 years later till we released our first brown spirit.
So you got some great bourbons and ryes we were tasting here. They're tasting amazing. Walk us through kind of some of your offerings and tell us a little bit about each one of them.
Yeah, so we got a couple different things here. We have our core, which is our bourbon and rye small batch that we do. Each batch is about 30 or more barrels. We never go over 40 typically. It's just, we always say 30 barrels, but sometimes you have to use 40 because it's got to be 30 barrels worth, right? So some barrels are a little bit lower yield than others, so sometimes we have to use a little bit more. Then we offer our single barrels. You'll see them out in the market. We do offer some here just the distillery, and we also have our double oak bourbon and double oak rye small batch too as well.
All right, so a lot of our, we do home brewing, but we're starting to, we have some stills, we've got some distillation products. I'm getting interested in it. Thank you for walking me through the process. But for our viewers here, you guys gonna walk them through that process, kind of, you know, what a distillation or distill process run, start to finish.
A couple of things, maybe just back up a step before distillation, something that I think a home distiller would be interested in because it's what we do here. It's probably more what you wouldn't want to run a continuous operation. And so you'd be apt to be doing a sweet mash process. Most of the industry uses the sour mash method. A lot of people are familiar with that term. We're a little different in that every batch of ours is a sweet mash batch. So sour mashing, by contrast, it recycles some of that leftover liquid at the end of distillation. There's benefits from doing that, but there are also some downsides as well. We found for our process, we like the sweet mash process. It's actually the reason it's called sweet is that when we run our process, we're going to be at a higher pH. Sour mashing, what makes it sour is that during fermentation, yeast create organic acids that gradually lowers the pH, making it more sour. So that has some benefits in helping prevent contamination. So what we do, we start at that higher pH, which might seem a little bit more challenging, but we ensure that we've got enough yeast to kind of overcome that challenge. And so we're operating at a higher pH, which actually yeast like better.
What pH is that? It's like for home brewing, you know, 5.2 to 5.4 is what we're shooting for our mashes. What is
ours are going to start closer to neutral.
Oh, okay. So yeah. More alkaline,
yeah.
7, 8.
Yeah, okay. Not quite 8, but okay. You know, between 6 and 7 would be pretty typical. Kind of wherever we're at with our water, our water source, our local, we use Louisville tap water. And so we're going to start at that pH, whereas, yes, that's what you're talking about is kind of a typical distiller pH
that's
as well.
That's the sour mash.
Sour mash method.
Okay.
Yep. And so that's going to have an effect on our flavor profile. We think it does give us some qualities that really make Peerless kind of stand out from some of the other brands out there. But you know, obviously we do, it does create some challenges, but we've had very good success with sweet mashing. And again, if you were gonna do a method, like a batch type method that a home distiller would use, mm-hmm. You'd probably be more in that type of realm where you'd be doing sweet mashing because you're not recycling anything. And then they would have the, you know, that would be their call. If they wanted to lower the pH, just if they were worried about contamination issues, I guess a home distiller could, you know, add something that would create more of an acidic environment, but that would be an option for
them. What is that, the grist of that mash? What does it look like? It's corn, right? Obviously a lot.
Yeah, for us, our mash bills for both our bourbon and our rye are gonna have the same three grains. It's gonna be corn, rye, and malted barley.
Okay, two row, just basic malted barley like we'd use in brewing.
Yeah,
okay.
Correct.
Yeah, and I think sanitation goes a lot with the people at home brew.
Absolutely.
Yeah. With being a sweet mash. You know, we have to deep clean, steam clean. We use medical grade stainless steel piping for our fermenters and our lines because between each fermenter, you know, we have to heat it up close to about 215 degrees and hold it for about 20 minutes because any contamination left over when we go to put that next batch in there will basically ruin it. Now, knock on wood, we've never had any issues. We're the right size and we've got it down to almost perfect science for it.
How long is that mash then? So I know when we were talking, the normal beer mash, about an hour, you know, 45 minutes, but I think it's a lot longer on this side, right?
Yeah, anywhere between 3 to 6 days on our fermentation. Okay. We don't run 24 hours, as Quinn was saying. You know, we only do production Monday through Friday, and that's from 6 a.m. typically till around, like 6 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
somewhere around there. So it could be 3 to 6 days, and our temperatures vary from 74 to about 86 degrees. That will let those fermenters get to.
All right, so we've mashed, we've created alcohol, but what percentage are we at then from that mash?
Typically, we're between 11 and 13% ABV on our beer right before we run it into our beer well to go over for distillation.
So you're using a certain type of yeast, too, to get to that, right? Because mm-hmm. like most ale yeast is not really tolerant at that, so it's a distiller yeast?
Yeah, it's called FP-01. That's the only name I know of it.
Okay.
We get it all from Firm Solutions, so if anybody out there is familiar with Wilderness Trail or Pat over there, brilliant, brilliant young guys over there, and they help develop our yeast strain for us.
Okay, so it's about 12-14%, and then what's the next step after that? Once we
we've before the beer gets to our column, we've got a beer heater. Then we use our column still. That's our first separation. Basically, what we're trying to do is separate the solids and the non-alcohol liquids, and so that gets separated out in the column still. Then our second stage is our doubler, and that really, when we finish that first column still stage, we're at about 120 proof, and then with our doubler, that gets us up to closer to 130 proof, and at that point, that's our new make finished proof. However, from that point, when we fill our barrels, we're filling at barrel entry proof of 107, and so we add RO water before we add our alcohol to the barrels for the reason of we don't add any water at the end. Mm. So everything goes in at that 107 barrel entry proof, and then it's bottled at barrel or batch strength. So our proofs of all these products you see on the table will be slightly variable. Typically about 108 to 115, although I know one of the couple of samples here are push that, but that's as we get older and older product, we're gonna have that situation where we're gonna start pushing those proofs gradually higher.
We were talking about earlier the heads and tails, right? So mm-hmm. the heads we wanna kind of get rid of. Talk to me a little bit about that process.
Yeah, I mean, so as long as we, basically it's really about temperatures and just having those, hitting those set points so that at whatever feed rate we're at, we're able to keep that column, get those temperature set points correct so that we're separating it out, that we're pulling off those different components and volatilizing those so that we're not having them end up in our finished product. Now, some of those do end up there. We do like a little bit of that because that does help us with flavor. Mm-hmm. And so kind of by design, that will result. But typically by just hitting those temperature set points,
that's going to be... If you're in that temperature range.
Yeah, that's going to really be the key thing in how you're going to get that.
You're tasting it every half hour.
Okay. Yep. So that I explained earlier, you know, just a little bit shift of temperature somewhere is going to change your flavor profile. one evening, you know, we've sat around and messed with temperatures just a little bit to see the difference in the flavor that you'll mm-hmm. get. But like I said, Caleb has trained each and every one of us that distill on what to look for and what exactly Peerless quality is.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Okay, so we've got we've now distilled it down. What's the next step? What are we doing after that?
That proof is going to be about 130, but when we fill our barrels, and you'll see some of the barrels that we filled today, we're going to add water. We're going to proof it down from that 130-ish proof down to 107. And so we're adding RO water. You know, for our cook process, we're just using, we're using city water, which is fine, but here we don't want any mineral content.
No minerals coming in, gotcha.
Okay. Right, so so then we bring that proof down to 107, and then we've got a really nice mix of both water and alcohol so that, you know, they're both good solubilizers, and so that gives those barrels just a really great setup for the aging process. And then we just leave those barrels alone for a while and let those flavors develop. And so then when, like I mentioned earlier, when we're ready to dump our barrels, there's no water addition. Everything gets bottled at barrel or batch strength. And so again, those typical proof ranges, it's probably gonna increase in proof because of the fact that during aging, even though you know, alcohol is very volatile, it evaporates pretty quickly. In a closed container, that's not the case because water is a smaller molecule than alcohol, so that's why alcohol can escape. Mm. And so that's why it drives your proof higher during aging, because that's what you're losing is the alcohol, but the water stays in there.
And that barrel process.
Or excuse me, the other way around. The water is leaving, the alcohol stays.
That barrel process, we walked through there, you guys mark some of them, you do single barrel, that collaborative, that was kind of, talk to a little bit about that. Are you guys doing the tasting and how you're blending and how that all comes about?
Yeah, so we'll get, typically, you know, every month or so, we'll get a list of barrels that become of age. So at that point, myself, some other people will go out to the rick houses, we'll pull a bunch of samples, we'll bring them back here, and then we have a great team. About five of us that will sit down, we'll go through samples, and from there we'll help decide what's the direction this barrel is going. Do we believe it's a true single barrel for the market, if we're here at the distillery? Is it good enough to go on our batches, or should we just wait on this one? You know, maybe this one needs a little bit more time. And then we also have to think about double oaking. Like, hey, this barrel is good, but it could be better. Why don't we throw it into another brand new barrel and see what happens with it? And we all taste different. We all have such a different palate, but I truly believe that's what makes our product and our barrel program and things like that so unique, is that it's not one person deciding on what flavor profile that we're going to be going for. We have, I can walk you through 20 different samples in the barrel program, and they're all going to be extremely different from one another. And I think that's just due to the quality control and the process that we have with these barrels when they do become of age.
So speaking of the age, how long are they typically in the barrel on the first round?
We don't taste anything until it's at least 4 years old.
4 years
old. That's probably the youngest we'll ever taste. Now, occasionally we may taste something a little bit, but that's just if we're trying to see, is this spot good for the barrels? Like, how are these aging? Did we do something different when we put them up there?
And then you said double oaking. So then after that 4 years in the barrel, it's going to go into another barrel? Is that the double oak?
Sometimes. And sometimes we'll even double oak them at 3 years old without tasting them.
Okay.
At 3 years old. It's like I said, we're trying to find, you know, this this was never a part of like in our portfolio. Mm-hmm. So we're still trying to figure out what's the best way to go about this. As I mentioned earlier, I just like to call them happy accidents, these double oaks that we had. So, you know, everything we do is a small batch, and a lot of questions we get is, well, what is a small batch? So there really is no definition of what a small batch is. Now, we use 30 to 40 barrels within our small batch, but you got to think, the bigger brands, 400 or 500, probably more barrels they're using in their batches. So if you can imagine, if I'm a big distillery and I'm running, you know, let's say 600 barrels for my normal batch, I could run, you know, 599 and call it my small batch. Mm. But I'd say we truly do a small batch here. Now, there are some pros and cons, you know, obviously fewer barrels that we're going to use, but we have to be very selective on what barrels. One bad barrel can ruin a whole batch. Mm. And at that point, it's very stressful. I have to go back and try to save a batch. So we are very choosy on what barrels go in here, right? We don't just look at a rick and say, hey, pull all these 40s off or dump it in, that's our batch. We hand taste each and every barrel that we put in there.
Since we're talking about barrels, I thought it was pretty neat. Let's talk about the cooperage, where you're getting your wood from, and the process that they're doing it, because it's a pretty unique process.
Yeah, it's called Kelvin Cooperage, originally from Scotland, based right here in Louisville. They're one of the smaller cooperages, but their quality is fantastic. So they don't use any gas or infrared when it comes time to char and heat up their barrels. They'll take all the leftover oak, and that's how they'll make their fire. So it's all natural heat they're going to be putting inside of there. We do a medium toast with a level 3 char inside of each and every one of our barrels. And it's a crazy place to go to, this cooperage. It's like medieval times over there, if you can imagine. I always like to say it's probably an HR nightmare to do tours. So they don't do tours and stuff to that over there, just because it's exactly what you probably picture a cooperage would look like back in the day.
Yeah, that's awesome. All right, so here's a question for you. What's the difference? What makes a bourbon and a whiskey a whiskey? What's the difference there?
All bourbon is whiskey, but not all whiskey is bourbon. It's kind of a simple way to say it. Bourbon is a is defined as people sometimes think it's only made in Kentucky, but it's actually anywhere in the United States. So it is a defined product made in the United States. It's got to be at least 51% corn. Okay. There's a few other things. New charred oak barrels is another one of the definitions. Some things about how we distill. 125 is the maximum barrel entry proof. I mentioned, you know, we typically come off the still at about that. You know, we're a little higher than that. Mm-hmm. But if you wanted to put it in a barrel, 125 would be the maximum. And so there's some other rules and things, just like with if you're making Scotch whiskey, they've got some of their own rules. But for our what we're making here, if we're making bourbon, it's got to be 51% corn in the mash bill. And then, of course, with rye. In that case, then we're going to have at least 51% of that grain be rye.
Be rye,
yeah.
Okay.
But both of our mash bills have those same three grains, as I mentioned earlier, corn, rye, and malt and barley.
And working with rye, you mentioned, you know, it's a, I know from making like a roggen beer, which is, you know, 50% rye mash, it's very oily protein, right? Like, so talk a little bit about that.
It's a little bit heavier, a little bit grittier, especially when we're cooking and distilling it. Usually when we're done with that, we have to deep clean everything because it's like a thick paste almost inside the cooker. So it sticks a little bit more. It takes a little bit longer, I would say, in the cooking process. So it's going to take us longer to heat it up and cool it down. And I don't know, Gwen, like I said, Gwen's definitely been around distillation a lot longer than I have, but I also find that it's a little bit slower in distillation. For me, when running the still with rye, it's a little bit different than when we're running it with bourbon.
All right, so you know, if I'm interested in getting into distillation and distilling, what are some tips you got for getting started?
So start off, if you're just getting into it, you know, you're not really sure. If you don't want to venture out into the distilleries first, start off at a good tasting store, like a liquor store that has a tasting bar, right? Ask all the questions you want to there. More than likely, whoever's going to be behind that bar, at least here in Kentucky, they're going to be pretty knowledgeable about any bourbon that they have back behind there. And then I would say, you know, show love to the little distilleries. Like here, we cook here, we distill here, we bottle here. When you walk in and see a tour, we take you through the whole process. So definitely don't feel like, you know, don't just hit up the big ones out there. Go to your craft distilleries, the ones that are doing things a little bit differently and that have a little bit more hands-on approach, and that you're going to get to see the whole operation from start to finish when you walk through there. Your big distilleries are great. I love them, but I would definitely say don't shy away from craft distilleries.
That makes sense too, especially from like as a home person getting into it, it's going to be more like the smaller places, right? We're not going to have all the fancy.
I'm sure you walked through here today and saw them like, oh, that looks
familiar.
Like,
yeah,
I know what that is.
Yeah.
So I'd definitely say craft distillery for any intro. For me, I feel like is the best way to go when you're first venturing into it.
Is there any, I know we talked about education, and you guys have mentioned there's a local place that teaches
yeah,
this.
Yeah, I can talk a little bit about that. There's a place there I know from personal experience. I participated in their course for Executive Bourbon Steward. It's called Moonshine University, and it's a really fun experience. They've even got their whole operation. They've got fermentation to distillation. So depending on where you're at, if you're at zero knowledge and just need to learn a lot, I mean, you can learn about the whole process from beginning to end, including sensory analysis. That's what my primary interest was. But even if you're interested in some of the production process related things, and their courses range from, you know, it could be a day long course, could be 3 weeks long. So kind of whatever.
However deep
you
want to get
into it. Just go online and just Google Moonshine University and you can find out all about it.
Awesome. Well, Gwen, John, this was amazing. This has been a great time. Thank you guys for sharing your time with us. And we've got some amazing bourbons here. So let's sample some more.
Okay.
Cheers.
Cheers.